Hi, I'm David Crow, and welcome back to The Infectious Myth. Thank you for tuning in to episode 55. You can email me with comments about the show or suggestions for future guests at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, and that's Crow with an E. You can like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. We're on iTunes and other podcast programs, and remember that I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, I'll send you a little thank you gift. And I'd just like to mention that today's guest, who is Wallace Thornhill, who graduated in physics at Melbourne University in 1965, he is a guest suggestion from Yasu. So thanks, Yasu, for suggesting today's guest. Wallace Thornhill then entered postgraduate studies, but decided to quit to join IBM Australia, believing that there was no place in academia for a heretic, and we'll find out why he considers himself a heretic in a little bit. That's something that many guests on this show have in common. He's independently studied the universe since then. He's co-author of books entitled Thunderbolts of the Gods and Electric Universe. He believes that much of what we believe about the universe, because we're told it on television, is wrong. And the name Electric Universe refers to his belief that electricity is much more important than gravity in the grand scheme of things, and the universe is grand. We will link to his website, holoscience.com, in the show notes. But before I get to Wallace, first some feedback. Bayat, who actually lives in the city of Calgary, which is where I live, who responded to a letter I wrote on the issue of mandatory vaccination, said, I follow you on PRN every Tuesday, and I'm learning so much from the wonderful people you have on as guests. Thanks for all the work you do. And thanks for letting us know about your feelings, or positive feelings about the show, Bayat. So now, welcome to the show, Wallace.
Thanks very much, David.
Yes. So can you describe what you mean by the electric universe?
Yes, it's a simplification of modern science. It's something that was done as a routine before the 20th century, and that is trying to find simpler ways of explaining things. Mm-hmm. And there were many scientists like Faraday who believed that the electrical force would eventually be found to be responsible for magnetism and gravity, particularly gravity. He was interested in trying to find out the relationship between electricity and gravity. Mm-hmm. I was inspired to attempt to find out by way back in the 50s when I was in high school by reading Velikovsky's work, Worlds in Collision, where he described a chaotic solar system. And whether or not you take on board his reconstruction of the events, is neither here nor there. He effectively showed that the solar system in the past has not been stable, mm-hmm. but somehow or another it rapidly achieved stability, but it defied Newton's laws. And this was the gauntlet that he threw down to astronomers, and they just stood back and said, ah, but it's the law.
Right. So just briefly, so Velikovsky's saying that historical events like thousands of years ago were actually from close calls with planets. That's what he believed. So the planets that sedately circle around the sun in their fairly well-defined orbits, he believes sometimes were moving in crazy ways before that, not that long ago.
Yes, the description of Venus as a comet was quite striking, and the life's work of several scholars since then have more or less forensically proven the case, and that one you can take to the bank, as they say. As for the participation of other planets and so on, and Velikovsky's reconstruction, there's been a lot of work done since, which has pieced together the history of the solar system going back maybe 10, 12,000 years or so, and it shows that the history of the Earth and the human race has been quite different to the sort of fairy story once upon a time, long, long ago, that we're taught. It's far more interesting, and electricity was involved because the ancients all recorded the thunderbolts of the gods and depicted them, not like any lightning that we see, but like you see in high-energy plasma labs.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if if the solar system was a lot more chaotic 10, 20, 30, 50,000 years ago, mm-hmm. I mean, doesn't that mean that we're just in a quiet time right now? I mean, has everything like stopped?
This has been a question that many people ask Velikovsky, I think. It was a singular event, let's put it that way. And there's no sign of anything like that happening again. It would require the entry of a large planetary-sized body into the solar system and undergo capture. The process of readjustment is the one that was recorded by the ancients.
Okay. Anyway, your theories, I think, are somewhat different than Velikovsky's because you're talking, I don't know if Velikovsky talked a lot about electricity, but your description of the sun I found quite interesting. The idea I have of the sun from what I've learned from listening to science programs, things like that, yes. is that it's a giant nuclear bomb, basically. Fission or fusion? I get confused. Yes, but you're saying fusion. And yes, it's the fusion that they try to get on the Earth, but they've never been able to capture it and generate electricity. But you're saying that it's actually an electrical system. So yes. What do you believe the sun is doing then?
Well, the first thing that made me think about that was the work of a fellow called Ralph Jurgens, an engineer who was... very good friend of Velikovsky's, actually, and was moved to study the sun because Velikovsky's theory involved electrical activity in the solar system, which meant that the sun itself was an electrical body. Well, the point is, Ralph Jurgens wrote that none of the observed features of the sun are derivable by theory, the fusion theory. There's not a single thing about the sun that is predicted by the fusion theory. The theory has been built to try and explain how the sun could shine for the assumed billions of years since it was born. And that was the entire rationale behind it. They had to find an energy source which would allow that. And, of course, when nuclear energy was discovered, it was grasped like men clutching at straws.
And, but doesn't nuclear energy have a tendency to get out of control? Like sun is it's not stable in a sense that it doesn't fluctuate, but relatively it's a stable object, size and energy output, things like that. So how could nuclear power?
Well, that's a good point. The nuclear theory doesn't explain that at all. In fact, the reactions that are required in the core. One of them, one of the critical ones, is sensitive to the power to the temperature to the fifth power, which means it's unstable. This night sky should be like the 4th of July.
Right.
But the electrical model, which Ralph Jurgens detailed, and he did an amazing piece of research on that, shows that the sun is actually, all bright stars are controlled by a kind of transistor action in the photosphere. Which controls the current, which is driving the sun. Now, that's not to say that all of the energy that the sun shines with is electrical. In fact, the nuclear reactions are occurring, but they're right in front of our eyes, in the photosphere. Mm-hmm. We have evidence for that in the neutrinos that have been imaged in a hazy sort of a way coming from the sun.
So you're saying basically that there's enough electrical activity that fusion can be generated by the electricity and the heat that's generated?
Yes. Yeah, there's a lot of misconceptions in modern science, and one is in fusion research that you have to use brute force and ignorance to smash nuclei together to release nuclear power. That's not the case. Nuclear reactions can be catalyzed just like chemical reactions, and so what's going on in the sun... I've suggested in many places, is that we have catalytic reactions, nuclear reactions taking place so that all stars generate heavy elements. In fact, the sun's spectrum shows the heavy elements there. They're right there in the photosphere.
Right. And are those heavy elements generated from the nuclear reactions?
Yes.
So as the hydrogen fuses together, it becomes heavier and heavier. So the, I thought fusion ended up with helium, and that was the end of it.
But no, the point is that some of the activity that takes place on the sun generates a lot of neutrons, and the neutron capture and subsequent beta decay will give you the gradual buildup of heavy elements. And the very fact that we see them in the Fraunhofer spectrum of the sun is evidence for this this model. It also helps explain not just bright stars, but it also explains strange behavior of red giants, flaring red dwarfs, white dwarfs, pulsars. They all can be explained by one theory. You don't need to make up special stories for each one.
Right. So a dark star, presumably there's less energy. So what's going
That's
on?
Right. Yeah. In that case, it hasn't established the kind of photospheric discharge, the bright discharge that a bright star has. It has what is probably best described as a chromospheric glow. But that glow is quite huge. This is why red stars tend to be giants. And even the so-called red dwarfs, I would suggest, are actually the glow is quite gigantic. And that planets can orbit within that glow, and it's the most likely place to find life in the universe. So there's all sorts of interesting ideas that flow from looking at stars as an electrical phenomenon.
And you're saying, are you saying that a star is basically a giant ball of plasma, which is like gas stripped of
its... No. Plasma cosmologists, and they have their own peer-reviewed literature in the IEEE Plasma Sciences journals. They have shown that stars form along what is in effect a cosmic lightning bolt within a molecular cloud, and we've seen images of this where the astronomers were surprised. The stars were spread out like beads on a string. Now, their only method of explaining this in a gravitational universe is by explosions and accretions and collisions. That's all they've got to work with.
Right. So if you have like a spiral galaxy, that it either means that the gravity is pulling everything into the center, or something blew up, and as it spins, it produces the spiral. Well,
there's a recent paper, actually, within the last few weeks, which suggested that the gravitational theory cannot explain spiral galaxies. It just doesn't work. But the plasma guys are able to do experiments in the lab and actually reproduce the rotation of a spiral galaxy, even in some detail, without even invoking gravity.
So it
shows that the spiral galaxies and so on are actually electromagnetic phenomena first and foremost, and gravity takes over once all of the electrical activity drops to a certain level.
So in a spiral galaxy, what is the gravitational effect of the stars and other things that are floating around on each other? I mean, it's huge, so they're quite far apart.
The distances are colossal, you know, like specks of dust miles apart. So the overall structure of the galaxy is controlled electromagnetically, I think. And when we get down to gravity itself, there is no real understanding of gravity. We have two descriptions. One is Newton's, which, by the way, doesn't include time. It means that gravity operates instantly. And this flies in the face of Einstein's theory of gravity, which is a purely hypergeometric theory, which doesn't explain anything, but is required because of his earlier work, which involved the speed of light being a constant and all of this sort of stuff. There are so many errors in modern science, it's almost unbelievable that we've managed to continue with them for a century now.
Well, actually, that's an interesting point, because I had, you know, I mean, light, but you do agree that light has a particular speed, right? Like the speed of light affects the speed at which light transmits through, goes through a vacuum.
The speed of light is entirely dependent on the nature of the medium through which it's going, and space is a medium.
Right, but at its maximum is a vacuum, and that's the speed of light. The constant is the maximum speed, or do you believe that light could go faster than the speed of light?
No, because light is it's a wave, and you can't wave nothing. So it's got to go through something. So even empty space has an ether, if you like. That's what Maxwell's equations require, and Einstein discarded the ether without explaining exactly how you can pass a light wave through nothing. You cannot do that.
And, of course, we can't have a pure vacuum, so it's hard to do experiments, because even the best human vacuum has a little bit in it, or it would just collapse everything.
Not only that, just think about it for a minute. There are trillions of neutrinos passing through every square centimeter of us and everything around us per second. So if you produce the best vacuum you can and remove every atom from a cylinder,
right,
it'll be teeming with neutrinos. So it's still full of matter. So this is what I say. Okay. Speed of light is dependent upon the medium, and the density of neutrinos in empty space will be the determining factor on the speed of light. The speed of light is a variable. In fact, it was amusingly pointed out to us at our last conference by one speaker that because they haven't been able to tie it down well enough, they now define the meter in terms of the speed of light. In other words, they've defined it to be a constant.
but if it's not a constant, then the meter's not a constant, which could cause a lot of problems for people trying to measure their houses.
That's right. Yeah. It's a reasonably constant.
Right.
When we come to gravity, we have this so-called universal constant of gravitation, which is the least constant of any of the physical constants. It varies, in the third decimal place from experiment to experiment, and even the same experiment repeated will give you a different answer. And this is to be expected when you understand the electrical nature of gravity.
Okay, so you were going to tie those things together. But just before we get to that, like, one thing I had always accepted was, okay, the speed of light is constant, and it's the maximum speed that anything can go at. Therefore, the speed of the gravitational force must be less than or equal to the speed of light. But like, that really doesn't make any sense unless gravity is transmitted by light, which it's not. I think everybody agrees.
Gravity is a direct electrical force. It's like tugging on the end of a string between the Earth and the Sun, for instance. And it's easy to check, because if the Earth was pulled to where the Sun was 8 minutes ago, you have in effect a force acting on the Earth which will tend to accelerate it out of the solar system, and all the planets would suffer the same thing. You know, the outer planets would be pulled to where the Sun was hours ago.
Right.
And that just doesn't work. It's an unstable situation. It's like a slingshot. But that doesn't happen. Well, I mean, we can measure quite accurately the distance between planets and between us and the Sun now. And we are tugged to where the Sun is at this instant.
Right. So I thought that the speed of the planet going in a straight line plus the force of gravity pulling it in one direction caused the elliptical orbit. Are you saying that's true, but it's just that gravity is electrical, or?
Yeah, gravity is a phenomenon. It's a form of the electric force. It's an extremely weak one, which is not explained by physics either.
Mm-hmm.
And it appears on the surface of the Earth to be unidirectional. In other words, there is no anti-gravity.
Right.
But this is purely, this is our problem, of course. We tend to make our science based on a very human-centered view.
What we can see and experience.
Yeah, what we can feel. I mean, we experience the Earth pulling us down every time we wake up and get out of bed.
Right.
The electrical model suggests that the gravitational force is actually a dipolar force, just like a magnet. The problem is that the other pole of the magnet is facing into the center of the Earth, which then raises all sorts of issues about what's inside the Earth. And I was interested to see a paper on that subject just recently from the Journal of Geophysical Research. And they're saying they're puzzled by what's down there. You know, it really is quite odd and doesn't fit with just an extrapolation of our beliefs about what gravity does and what gravity is. It just doesn't fit.
And so if gravity is an electrical force, then that would imply that the objects being attracted would have different gravity based on their electrical properties, their magnetic properties.
That's right.
Affect it. So the Earth has a lot of iron, so it's probably pretty electrical, pretty magnetic for a cold object.
Well, we have all sorts of problems there too. The fact is that I said before that stars formed in these cosmic lightning bolts, but the researchers in plasma physics have shown that what happens in those lightning bolts is that the heavy elements get attracted to the center, and then the lighter elements, including hydrogen and helium, form an outer atmosphere. So all of the stars and planets will have the heavy elements at their centers.
Now,
So the sun has a planetary-type interior, if you like. Somewhere down underneath all of that bright electrical activity is an object which is more like the Earth, only much bigger.
Right. I mean, that's a theory, but we really can't tell too much about what's in the center of the sun.
You certainly can't, and the reason for that is that mass is an energetic variable too. So just by measuring the gravity of an object, you cannot say what it's made from, because mass is not equivalent to the amount of matter in that object. Mass is an energetic variable. E equals mc squared has been telling us that for a century, and nobody's paid any attention.
Oh, okay. So the gravitational pull, but
Well, you can see that with that comet 67P. The astronomers are convinced that it must be icy inside, but its density or its gravitational field suggests that it's not even all ice. It has to be sort of porous as well. I would suggest that the comet could be exactly what it appears to be, and that is a lump of rock. It's just that its electrical stress, internal electrical stress, is such that it appears to be much made of much lighter material.
Oh, so the more, you're saying the more electrical activity, the lighter something gets?
Or? It depends on the charge on the surface. If you add or subtract charge from the surface of a planet or a comet or any other body, it will alter the apparent mass and gravitational field of that body because it affects the electric dipoles within the body.
Okay. So you're saying it's kind of like a magnet or an electrically charged object. It's the voltage, if you like.
Yeah,
that is measured.
Yeah, it's the electrical energy stored in that body, and that can be, that adds to the mass. In fact, we have evidence, that, you know, supreme evidence on Earth of the change in the Earth's gravity in prehistory, and that is the dinosaurs. The dinosaurs could not have lifted themselves off the ground in present-day gravity. In fact, when they were first discovered, it was decided they must be waders. They needed water to, offset their weight.
Right, like a hippopotamus.
But that was forgotten, and now, of course, we have Jurassic Park with the things prancing around and standing on their hind legs and browsing on the tops of trees. That's pure nonsense.
I guess we shouldn't take Jurassic Park too seriously as a way to understand dinosaurs. But it was a good movie, if you can suspend disbelief. So
yeah.
are you saying that at the time of the dinosaurs, the Earth had less gravity?
Yes, it was calculated on the base of the cross-sectional strength of bone and muscle that the gravity of the Earth at that time was about a third of what it is today. So the demise of the dinosaurs was much more interesting than a simple collision, an asteroid impact. Once again, the gravitational people only have collisions to deal with, and so they're highly restricted in their possibilities.
I don't. This is something I just thought of, but I was very interested in the theories of continental drift or more plate tectonics, which, when I was in university, were relatively new, newly accepted theories. Geologists had been resisting this for a long time, but according to that theory, the pole of the Earth, the magnetic pole, has flipped. Quite often, like every few hundred thousand years or something, or every few million years through history. So what do you think causes that, and what impact would that have on the Earth when the pole just kind of magnetic pole tips itself upside down.
Those magnetic field excursions of the Earth are suggestive of the electrical interference of nearby large planetary objects. In other words, the thunderbolts of the gods can seriously disturb the magnetic field of the Earth at the time. And, of course, during those disturbances is the time when you'll have most volcanic activity and rocks passing through their Curie point where they record the Earth's magnetic field at the time.
Right. So if a rock gets hot, then it's magnetized by the surrounding, and when it cools below the Curie point, its magnetic field solidifies at that point.
That's right. And often the magnetic field that's been trapped is stronger than the present-day Earth's field, which is what you'd expect when there's serious electrical activity going on a planetary scale. The other thing is that the Earth's gravity is not... magnetism is not really well explained. Talking about an iron core sloshing around inside is it's mere... it's a story, you know.
Speculation, yeah.
As I said, we don't know what's inside the Earth or even what state it's in because our theory of gravity is incorrect. But one of the aspects of the Earth's dipole field that was examined by geophysicists some years back, decades ago actually, was to consider if the Earth was a charged spinning body, it would produce a dipole magnetic field. But they frightened themselves by calculating what voltage would be needed. But they were just looking at it from a purely electrostatic point of view, which means that the voltage they came up with was millions of volts per meter or something in the Earth's atmosphere, which was clearly not what we find. It's only about 100 volts per meter. What they didn't understand was plasma physics, which shows that these extreme voltages can be sustained in a plasma by what's called plasma sheaths, Langmuir plasma sheaths or double layers, and it means that the voltage tends to drop over a very short distance across these sheaths. There may be multiples of them.
And where would these plasma sheaths be? Inside the core or in the atmosphere?
No, one of them is in the ionosphere. Another one is the magnetosphere. The magnetosphere is the one that protects us from the solar electrical environment.
Right.
The ionosphere is the one that is sort of midway between the magnetosphere and the Earth's surface, so it acts as the intermediary there.
Right.
And we have clouds in the atmosphere which act as a kind of leaky condenser, and so you get lightning discharges through those clouds preferentially. I mean, you can get a bolt from the blue if you don't have clouds, and this is what happens on other planets that don't have water clouds.
So is the Earth part of the sun's electrical field? And you talked about lightning bolts of the gods. Are these lightning bolts coming from the sun or...
No, they're close approaches between planets. When I said they have a sheath around them that protects them from the external field, they're the magnetospheres, which are cometary shape plasma formations. When two planets, when their magnetospheres touch, that's when the two planets see each other electrically, and that's when you're likely to get interplanetary thunderbolts. And they take the form of a plasma discharge in a low-pressure gas, which is quite different from lightning. It takes on a structure and a quite striking series of forms, up to about 80 different forms. And we had a big breakthrough with our work. When I say our work, Dave Talbot and I, who started this project back in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
It was about 2000, I think, 2001. When we teamed up with a leading expert in plasma instabilities. He worked at the Los Alamos labs. And we called it a convergence of ideas from plasma physics to the ancient forensic records of these thunderbolts of the gods. And this guy was absolutely astounded. He said, "My God," he said, "I've been walking past..." I go out hunting, you know, near Los Alamos in the desert there. And he said, I walked past the Indian petroglyphs without even recognizing the fact that what they were chiseling on the rock were my plasma instabilities. all of those strange figures that you see that look like aliens or, you know, quite weird structures.
So now we're converging with Velikovsky. So if there's two planets that are going to have a magnetic field that is interacting, you're saying that there were two planets or maybe a planet and a moon that came rather close together in what you've talked about Saturn. Is this one of the planets you believe did this?
It's without a lot of background information, I hesitate to talk about that because it seems more science fiction than anything you've ever read. And yet,
it does.
We can back it up with all of the forensic evidence you can imagine. But it seems that we are the aliens in this solar system. We were part of a minor star system, a brown dwarf. And as I said earlier, brown dwarfs are probably the place where we will find life in the universe. Around bright stars at great distance like we are is much less likely. Now, astronomers in recent decades have come to the same kind of conclusion that life could exist and would be likely around dim red stars if the planets were orbiting quite closely to that star. But the electric universe shows that a red dwarf is not a dwarf star at all. It has a huge bloated red envelope. And there's evidence for this too, by the way, from astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
When that happens, the planets, you can imagine Jupiter, for instance.
Right.
Its innermost moons, Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto, are all orbiting within Jupiter's magnetosphere. Now, if that magnetosphere was to light up, a red color,
right,
that'd be, in effect, a brown dwarf. But its innermost bodies, which are planet-sized, would be its planets. And they would be in an environment where they're receiving even radiation over their entire surface. It wouldn't matter what their day cycle was or how their axis was tilted or anything like that. As long as they're inside that glowing sphere, they get the same energy. And it's a reddish color. And it's also got a lot of ultraviolet, the blue end of the spectrum too. So you end up with a purplish light.
Okay, Jupiter and Saturn, people believe, are basically large balls of gas. You were saying at one point there was more electrical activity and they would have been glowing as small stars?
When they're outside the sun's environment, which is called the heliosphere, then you're outside the sun's electrical environment. In that situation, if we were to take Saturn and or any of the gas giants and put them beyond that heliosphere, they would light up once more as dwarf red stars. The universe provides the energy. We don't have to look for nuclear fusion going on inside a body to produce that energy. And all of this has interesting, almost biological overtones, because those bodies in achieving stability in their electrical environment have no other recourse, because they don't have a bright photosphere, but to shed matter.
Mm-hmm.
And they can shed matter of planet size. And this apparently was the origin of Venus. It's why it's so hot still, because it was the process of what we call proto-Saturn on approaching the sun's solar system. Its adjustment was violent enough for it to eject a body the size of the Earth.
Okay. So the Saturn, the forces between Saturn and the sun, ejecting matter from Saturn, which then was captured by the sun.
Yeah, the star that comes in, the dimmer one, switches from being an anode in the galactic discharge to a cathode, and the two types of discharge are quite distinct, quite different. And it's that switch, which is the same thing as a comet suffers, and we know comets jet material out as they approach the sun.
Right.
Saturn would have done the same.
Right. Now,
By the way, the rings of Saturn are the remnant of that ejection, the material that was ejected.
I would have thought that if a planet like Saturn was still electrically active, it would be glowing, but you're saying that it would have to go further from the sun before it would start glowing.
The plasma discharges are quite discontinuous effects. They can go from dark mode to glow mode to arc mode, the three major modes of plasma discharge. So the switch from one to the other can be quite sudden.
So we could wake up tomorrow morning and Saturn could be glowing and our magnetic field might north might be south. Like these things could happen overnight or maybe overnight?
It would require some pretty drastic things happening to the sun for that to occur. I don't know how we ended up in the situation we're in, but one of the aspects of the electric universe is that capture is electrically moderated. The problem with gravity is that you've got no mechanism of losing energy. An incoming object would just swing in past the sun and then swing out again with very little energy loss.
It's hard to see how, like if the Earth was, you know, barreling through space towards the sun, you would think that it would be more likely to get to fall into the sun or to just be deflected and just keep on going.
No, you'd have to be a bullseye to actually hit the sun, and the chances of that are astronomically against. So you would go into an orbit, but the thing is that this discharge activity that takes place is actually transferring kinetic energy for electrical energy. So this is the energy transfer mechanism that's essential for capture. And the same thing occurred with our moon. All the stories about the moon was formed by a collision with the Earth. Once again, you know, the gravity model only has collisions to provide answers.
Right.
The moon is a fairly recent capture, and it looks like one of the satellites of the outer gas giants. So it was probably one of the bodies that was stripped off either proto-Saturn or even Jupiter at some stage, was captured by the Earth. The thing is that because we don't understand gravity and its dipole basis,
right,
we don't understand the fact that bodies can actually repel one another. And this is something that, of course, has never occurred to astronomers. They just assume that gravity is an attractive force, and that's all there is to it.
Right. But, so like I said earlier, it's believed, okay, the moon's going, basically wants to go in a straight line, but it's continually pulled into a curve by gravity. Mm. But are you saying it's actually a balance of positive and negative forces so that orbit is due to the electrical environment?
No, it's due to gravity, but gravity can also have a repulsive side to it as well as an attractive side. And if you think about it, all large bodies, planetary bodies, will have the nuclei of atoms off-center in the atom, pulled towards the center of the body, which means that all of the atoms become little electric dipoles, and the sum of all those dipoles is what forms the gravitational field. So you have a negative gravitational field facing outwards from all of these bodies. So if they come close enough, they'll actually repel one another. They'll avoid collision. This is something that has taken me decades to figure out, and now I find that Newton had a colleague, Fatio, his name was, and he proposed this idea, and it was thought about seriously because it gives the same one over r squared law. That is that a shielding effect. But my model's even easier. It has the same effect, but it's the same as having two naked negative charges. They will repel one another as the one over r squared law.
Right. And do you think there's any evidence in the universe for gravitational repelling?
Yes. I think possibly the best candidate is the so-called black holes at the center of galaxies, where you have the an apparent gravitational field of millions or billions of suns.
Right.
Any object that manages to get itself into a position at the focus of that field, it's a plasma effect, by the way. It's a plasma focus effect, which has a donut shape. So any matter that finds itself in the center of the donut will have an ejected force of millions or billions of suns, which, and this is what we see, of course, matter being ejected at near light speed out of the center of galaxies. So there's evidence for it.
Because a black hole, I thought, was supposed to suck things in, and then there was no return.
A black hole is a mathematical mistake. You divide by zero and you end up with infinity. And the gravitational force is so close to zero that it, if you divide by it, you end up with the requirement for an infinite mass. And this is basically what happened. But it is a plasma focus effect. It's called a dense plasma focus, where electromagnetic energy is funneled into a tiny plasma donut. And you can store an enormous amount of electromagnetic energy in a very tiny space. So the so-called black hole at the center of the galaxy is a plasmoid, as it's known. Now,
And you're saying that it would attract things on one side, pull them in through electrical forces, and then it would spit them out the other side through a repelling force.
Well, some of these ideas are fairly new because this whole process of understanding the universe is an ongoing thing. And so there's plenty of work that still needs to be done to tie these ideas together and also give some mathematical verification for some of the ideas and the magnitudes of the forces involved. But the point is that plasma cosmologists are able to do experiments in the lab, electromagnetic experiments with plasma, which can reproduce these effects and have done for decades, but they're ignored by astronomers because they're taught a version of plasma physics which treats it as a magnetized fluid, which is only a tiny part of the picture. Plasma is much more interesting and dynamic than the way it's taught to astrophysicists.
One person I wanted to talk about, because you worked with him before his death, was Halton Arp, and you had some overlap in ideas with him, but I also wanted to talk a little bit about censorship, which you kind of referred to in your belief that you couldn't have survived in graduate school because your ideas were heretical. So Halton Arp criticized the Big Bang, the expanding universe, that kind of thing, and I think you agree with him on that.
Well, he found the empirical evidence that said that the universe is fairly static, and it's of unknown extent and unknown age, and he produced the evidence for it, and lots of it. I mean, the chances of him being incorrect were millions, tens of millions to one against. And the ideas that this brought up for him mimicked very closely the ideas I'd come up with, approaching it from the electric universe point of view. In fact, I hold him in the highest esteem. He was a man who was prepared to not to bow to pressure to conform. I mean, what was done to him was just completely unconscionable.
Well, briefly, he was an American astronomer, and I think he worked in San Diego at was Palomar. And once he started coming up with theories that were antagonistic to the mainstream of astronomy, his telescope time was removed.
That's right.
And so he ended up in Germany, I think, doing research there because he couldn't do research in the U.S. anymore.
It was funny because he ended up at the Max Planck Institute in Germany where they were doing high-energy observation of deep space in X-rays and so on. And the X-ray data more or less confirmed his work that he'd done in the optical. He was one of the top rising astronomers as a young man. He produced the Atlas of Peculiar Galaxies. And it was that observational work that put him onto the discovery that quasars were sort of selectively positioned near active galaxies. And then he was able to predict that you would find quasars in particular positions, which was borne out. He was supported by Sir Fred Hoyle and Margaret and Geoffrey Burbage, well-known astronomers, and a vast number of amateur astronomers who, using their own telescopes, could actually pick up the connections between these quasars and the active galaxy. In other words, there was a stream of material between them.
Right, and One of the things that's a sort of a dogma of modern astronomy is that from the redshift of a star, which is the shifting of the frequency of light, you can tell if something's, or basically how far.
That's right. The idea is that it was supposed to be all related to the speed of the object away from us.
Which is relative to the distance, if we believe that the universe expands.
If we believe in an expanding universe, exactly. Yes.
And so, how do you or Halton Arup, or how would he explain the redshift if there can be stars of different redshifts that are close to each other? Then what does the redshift mean?
The redshift is a measure of the age of the body. A newly born object from the center of an active galaxy has a high redshift, in other words, low energy radiation. And over time, that redshift changes. It gets the redshift moves towards the blue end of the spectrum, but it does so in quantized steps. And now, this is something which brings you down into particle physics, because it's said that quantum effects are the realm of the subatomic. And here we see quasars and galactic observations showing quantized effects, which shows that the redshift is actually a subatomic phenomenon within the body. It's got nothing to do with the speed of the object away from us.
Okay, because there, I think, I only know a little bit about his work. I'm not an astronomer, but there could be two stars that he believed were actually very close and connected with dramatically different redshifts, and one would be older than the other, is what you're saying.
Yeah, the galaxy that gives birth will have a low redshift. When it ejects matter, it has a high redshift, and it tends to eject material episodically so that you get a string of these objects stretching away along the axis of rotation of the galaxy. And when you look at them, the redshift drops as you move away from the galaxy, the parent. And Halton Arup showed that these objects gain in mass, which is, as I said before, mass is an energetic variable, and eventually they go into orbit about their parent. So you can actually look at the genealogy of galaxies. In fact, the stories about the Andromeda galaxy smashing into ours in so many million years is nonsense. It's based on the idea that the Andromeda galaxy has a blue shift with respect to us, which means that it's older. It means it's older, not that
right.
It's coming towards us.
Oh, okay. Now, that would mean, if I understand this, that in like a spiral galaxy, the oldest things would be on the outer edges, right? So shouldn't you see, according to the distance, a spiral galaxy, everything's about the same distance from us, so they should all have the same redshift throughout the entire spiral galaxy, is that not the case?
Yes, a particular galaxy, Halton Arup pointed this out. He said, we do not find a gradation in redshift across a galaxy, a large spiral galaxy. It appears that the redshift change when it comes is something which is rapid, it's sudden. And this, of course, comes back to the electric force operating at speeds which cross a galaxy in a fraction of a second.
So it's kind of like when you add power to a neon tube, it will be sitting there doing nothing, and then all of a sudden, boom, it's on, and maybe it would change. So you're saying it's some shift, and then everything lights up the same way, basically?
No, the redshift itself is a change in the mass of the subatomic particles within the atoms that are emitting, which means that some of the so-called physical constants that we measure on Earth are not actually constants, they're variables, but they're quantized variables.
Okay.
And the redshift changes because the mass of the electron goes through a tiny change, but when it does so, all other electrons, all matter in the universe is connected, let's put it that way. So when one changes, it's like a chain reaction, but the force that's causing the change, the information is available across the galaxy in practically an instant. So the change is sudden, and it'd be interesting to know what would happen in our galaxy when we have such a quantum shift.
Yes. Well, I mean, hopefully we live in boring times, because it sounds like some of the things that you're describing could probably be the end of life on this planet.
I don't think so.
No. Well,
it seems to me that life is an attribute of the universe, which is universal.
Yeah, and if you're saying that the dinosaurs have been affected by this, you're not saying that these changes wiped out all life on the planet. It wiped out the dinosaurs, but obviously a lot of other things like mammals survived just fine. Yeah.
It seems to me, and this is a pure conjecture, that life, the information for producing life is available throughout the universe. The information is there. So wherever there's a niche in a physical environment that satisfies something that's been learnt elsewhere in the universe, then life can form in that new environment. I mean, on Earth, we're continually surprised by where we find life, you know, in miles deep rock, in the bottom of ocean trenches and things like this.
Yes, yes.
In anoxic environments.
Lots of places that 100 years ago people would have said it was impossible to find life.
Exactly.
There.
Yes, yes. So my view is that life will exist wherever it possibly can and where it's learned to exist anywhere in the universe. This gets over the problem that you have with the Darwinian theory where everything that happens is by accident. It's not. The geological record shows this. You get sudden changes and new life forms appear seemingly out of nowhere with no precursor. It's just because the environment has changed.
Yes.
And we're also subject to the environment. The body, the embryonic development and so on is affected by its environment, and that includes the electrical environment.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think in the 50s when DNA was discovered, they developed a dogma that everything's driven by DNA,
yes.
But that's clearly an absurd theory.
We're still driven by that dogma with our GMO and interference in living systems when we don't really know what we're doing. We're just experimenting.
Well, human beings love acting above their pay grade.
Well, I think the problem is that science and scientists are largely unaccountable for what they do. They experiment on us with no thought given to involving us in the discussions. I mean, they did that with the atom bombs and the nuclear fusion bombs, you know, the hydrogen bombs.
Yes.
I remember at school when I was in primary school, I was told about the hydrogen bomb. They're going to set it off in the ocean. I thought, my God, the ocean's full of hydrogen. Yeah, what are these fools doing?
Well, there was a fear when they set off the atmospheric bombs that it would just like eat up the entire atmosphere, and luckily that didn't come true. But that's a pretty dangerous game to be playing.
I know, but they continue to do it, and we need to have our science education that needs to be much broader and much better, so that people can be brought into the discussion. It's not true that you need a science education to understand these things. As Einstein once said, if you can't explain it to the barmaid, then you don't understand it yourself, and I hold strongly to that view.
Yes, and a friend of mine, Dr. Henry Bauer, talks about scientism, which is the institutionalized science. Yes. And in one of your presentations from last year, you showed a mainstream scientist presented with the question of, if the universe is infinite and it's expanding, you know, how do you explain this? And really what he said, I mean, as I said many times in the show, I'm not an astronomer, but I thought this is garbage that he's putting out. But because he's doing it on TV and he's laughing and everybody's laughing with him, everybody thinks, oh, he must be so much smarter than us. We couldn't possibly be that smart that we could come up with what sounds like garbage, which is actually incredibly intelligent thought.
Yes, and I thought the real kicker at the end was the other Nobel Prize winner in medicine who turned to him and said, well, that just shows you how smart mathematicians are or scientists are. And this is the problem. Mathematicians are, they use a tool. They are more like chess players than scientists. They know the moves. They know what the chess pieces are, but they cannot explain the game, what it means, you know. So unless the scientists, when they stand in front of a blackboard full of all these mathematical runes, can explain what each symbol means in simple physical terms, then that scientist does not understand what he's talking about.
Yeah, definitely quantum physics is not barmaid material. And I'm not putting down barmaids, but referring to the general population with maybe a high school diploma or a a college degree in something other than physics. But I mean, when we teach science history, there's a lot of things that were brilliant breakthroughs that now, when they're explained to us, seem obvious.
Yes.
And yet, a lot of modern science just sounds like gobbledygook.
Well, science fiction. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's all sorts of reasons for that, I think. I think the major one was the switch to massive government funding of science mm-hmm. after the First World War, or during the First World War.
Right.
And it's continued ever since.
Exponentially.
Although
I think governments are at their limits of what they can afford in funding science.
Well, I'm not surprised, because the crazy experiments they dream up, like the Large Hadron Collider and the gravity wave telescopes, when we don't know what a gravity wave is. The politicians are not the best people to decide whether the experts are telling them something that's complete nonsense or whether it's worth pursuing.
Well, the experts have a pretty good system, because they say, look, you know, you're politicians, you don't understand science, so your job is just to throw money at us, and you put us in charge of who gets what. But what your job is, every year you have to increase by 5 or 10% what you throw at us, and we'll tell you what we're going to do with it.
Yeah, I think the point is now that the pronouncements from scientists have become so profoundly silly that we can involve the public in the debate. But we need to somehow draw attention to this. Now, the media is not actually in this game, because science journalists haven't got a job if they start poking holes and doing investigative journalism in science. You know, the scientists close the doors and won't talk to them.
Yeah, science.
So all they do now is it's just science by press release.
Yes.
You know, the press release comes out of the science department, and it's more or less printed as without any question.
You're right. The only choice of the journalist is, like, which press releases do they put into the newspaper.
That's right.
That's not necessarily an unbiased or intelligent choice either. We've come to the end of our hour. I can't believe it's been an hour already. It's been a fascinating discussion, and I hope you didn't mind talking to somebody who knows relatively little about astronomy, but...
Not at all.
Very
it's good practice for me.
Yeah. I'll be thinking about this for a while. So thank you very much for joining me today.
And thank you, David, for the invitation.
And thank you to the audience for listening to yet another episode of The Infectious Myth. Goodbye.